Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. And I have a great guest today. We're going to get to her in a second. She's a real trendsetter in the California comedy scene, LA, actually the national comedy scene. And it's amazing. She has some good stories and she has a lot of stuff going on. And I just want to tell you real quick, two quick things. One, I want to thank the people at Ra Spa. It's Ra Organic Spa, right located on 119 North San Fernando Boulevard. The owner, Chris, I've known for a while. My girlfriend's flying in from back east and I pick her up at the airport Thursday night. And actually, so he comped us with a couples massage on Friday, which I've never done. So if you're going to get a massage, go to Ra Spa. And also, there's a great show on the same station called Geek World, and they have a big contest right now. So you can send in an email, mail@geekworldradio.com, and basically you're doing a contest and send them a joke. And anyone who sends a joke either gets a Joe Coy or a JB Smoove comedy CD. So send them that, and the best gets both. So that's my little plugs. But I want to bring my first guest today, a lady who's known as On Cabaret, which is a big show. We have Beth Lapidus. How you doing, Beth?
Hi, I'm well. Thanks.
Good.
Hi, Steve.
I've never met. It's so funny. I always said this. A lot of comics I know on a show, I've worked with them or I've known them. You I never met. I tracked you down through Facebook. And yeah, but it's great because you have such a you're such a name in the comedy world. As we say, you know, comics, you know, in the civilian world, they might know you, but if a comic doesn't know you or your name, it means like a hack and like Duluth.
Oh, that's sweet.
But it's true. You know, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Now, did you, how long have you been out here?
I've been out here 1,000 years.
Okay. In New Haven, how long did you live? I mean, did you go to high school?
New Haven, Providence. And then okay. I went to school in Providence at Brown, and then okay. New York. I did my early years as a performance artist and then comedian in New York,
okay.
And then L.A.
Now did you know you wanted to do comedy? Did you know you were going to perform when you were a kid, or did you have any idea?
I knew I wanted to perform. Okay. I had that thing, but I didn't. I knew I wanted to be an artist. I more wanted to be Gertrude Stein Johnny Carson.
Isn't it funny how we do that? And now were your parents, like my parents were always very... They were very supportive, and it's funny because I come from my dad is like Republican Presbyterian WASP.
Oh, really?
But my mom's parents were right off the boat, immigrants off the boat, and she was like Austrian Catholic, you know, but she was very liberal, you know, and it was just very funny, but they always encouraged me. Like, I took art classes when I was young and stuff like that.
Likewise. Very encouraged. My parents were always encouraging, though baffled.
Okay.
Baffled. If you want, sure, that would be awesome for you. If that's the... You know, I used to watch The Tonight Show with them. I mean, I would get into bed and watch The Tonight Show. There was that sort of vibe. It wasn't a highly cultured household.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of higher... I was the one being... I would, like, go to the Yale Museum and sit in front of Hoppers, and I would go to the art theater, but that wasn't part of, like, my upbringing.
No,
I had the Funk and Wagnalls Encyclopedia, which I always resented. I was like, you got these at the supermarket. Our encyclopedias are from the supermarket.
Made you? I mean, and it's just, I mean, how you're going to the museums. I mean, I don't know. When I was a kid, my parents would take us to the Philadelphia Art Museum.
Yeah.
And honestly, it was. And looking back now, it's great. And they would take us to like outside the high school. There'd be like a jazz concert. I still remember they took us to see the Unsinkable Molly Brown with Tammy Grimes.
Wow.
And I cried when they shot the guns off because I was scared. But looking back,
yeah, Batman scared me. I thought I didn't know Batman
really?
Was funny. Yes, I was a very sensitive child.
That's
it's very sensitive.
So, but it's like it's funny for me looking back now. I'm glad they taught. But as a kid, I hated it. But you, as a kid, what made you? Was it something inside? What
made you want to?
Yeah. What feeded you that thirst? Like, we were all about just going out and playing Jailbreak, you know, and stuff like that, you know, at night. What made you feed that thirst? I mean, it's very cool.
You know, I think you're born with it somehow. Okay. I was sick as a child. I was in the hospital for a while.
Okay.
And you can never know chicken and egg. I mean, do you become an artist because you were separated out? Or did you, you know, sometimes I think, well, I made myself sick because I was so different and weird and just, you know, I affected my blood and, you know, whatever.
Well, I think the kids would do that. It's like, I used to get stomach aches because these two kids would pick on me.
I had like a blood disease.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It was more than, you know.
Okay,
So I don't know. But I think we come into this world with, I don't know, I do believe we come into this world with not necessarily an agenda.
Okay.
But sometimes, you know, we're living in a world that's so crazy right now. Everything is so, like, massive change, transition into the new age or whatever that, you know, we think is happening. End of the times.
Right.
right, right.
Something's going on,
exactly.
though. And I once heard somebody say, if you're on Earth now, you volunteered to be here.
Okay. So.
And that kind of resonated, and I think about that. And I think, well, you have a mission, and, you know, people come. You see athletes. How do you know you want to be an athlete?
Right.
You know?
How do you, yes.
How do you know? How do you know? You just gravitate towards something.
Yeah, that's probably true, because it's also like, and you see some of these professions, like, how do you know, like, some guy who develops, like, amazing computer program, especially people who are older. Because when I'm 46.
Oh, you don't look
come on, I'm 46, and I back the computers. There was like just like a few kids
yes.
in my class, and now they're like these huge baby. Because Noam is doing. My cousin went to UMass as a computer engineer, and Noam's doing computers. I mean, this is back in 1983 when we were freshmen in college.
Partly, it's like finding your mission. I mean, I think the thing about life is to find your gift and find your mission. If you have a mission, it's always easier to
right.
go through life, because life can be hard.
Yeah,
you know. So if you have a mission, it gives you reason to keep going.
Okay, so you're going to the art museums. You're getting cultured. Okay, now what makes you? What do you remember the first
reading.
Time you were on stage, or do you remember? Was it?
Well, you know, as a child, I used to do the crazy thing of like standing on the. You know, the fireplace has the ledge.
Right.
You know, lip syncing. My parents had some wooden dowel, you know, something that I would lip sync to and do in front of their friends and. In school, I never really wanted to be an actress per se.
Okay.
It was always dance, somewhere where I was me.
Okay.
Not stand up, but dance, choreography, performance art, kind of, I'm me
okay.
kind of stuff. In college, I lived in a crazy modern dorm.
Well, Brown, it's funny. Brown is, I had a few friends, because I had my high school from Cherry Hill East, uh-huh. they went to Brown. And, I mean, this guy, my friend Ben Compton, was just telling me that, like, the competition in these Ivy League schools is just crazy about, like, with the getting the grades. He said it was, like, a different world.
It's, well, honestly, Brown, one of the things I loved about it was you go to 4 years of school with SNC, satisfactory, no credit.
Okay.
Not one grade.
Oh, really?
I was like, I'm not ever going to go to school again. I don't need grades. This is it. This is the end of the line with school.
Okay.
I'm just here to learn.
See, that's good. That's
so
good.
So I was free to then just, you know. But we had this room. We would call it the funny room. It was, you know, built that year. And there was this room that seemed to have no purpose.
Okay.
So we called it the funny room. And we would go in. A group of, you know, dozen, maybe two dozen friends, a dozen at any one time, sit in a circle, and somebody would take a pie from, it gets so high.
Okay.
And pass the pie around, and there was a window outside the room where we would do these shows in the window for each other. And friends of mine recently recall, I had totally forgotten about, like, that was your first show. Like, you would do this show in this window, the Beth show, and the Beth and Bruce show, and you had all these shows where you'd shoes as, like, you know, crazy, it's crazy stuff. So I did that, and I was also an avant-garde choreographer at
okay.
school. And
when what was your major?
Oh my God.
I want to, because if you say like physics, I'm going to go, what the hell's
no,
that?
No, but I did spend some time in New York studying particle physics on my own.
Wow.
And I used to do these shows called, I did a whole thing about science, because I was like, oh my God, you know, they're going to figure out the universe and I'm not going to get it, because I didn't ever like understand science. I got to read this stuff. So then I started making performances about that. I did this one show called Crash Course.
Okay.
You know, anyway.
What was that about?
About particle physics and being a girl and like trying to fall in love and understand particle physics.
Now, we'll get to it, but we'll get back to what you're talking about. But how did the crowd respond? I mean, it's just like, it's such a, I mean, you go out to see a show. How does
well,
the crowd?
Well, the crowd in that case was a performance art.
Okay.
I started, it's funny we're talking about this. I saw some performance art last night with a friend supporting another friend. And I was like, if I never see one more, you know, I don't know. You try to stay open. But anyway, I, out of school, gravitated towards performance art.
But what was your major? I'm sorry.
Oh, modes of expression, art, dance, and writing. It was an independent concentration.
It's so funny when you think. I have a degree in business management. But I went to a school, it was a small state school in New Jersey called Richard Stockton. And it was started by hippies on the boardwalk of Atlantic City.
Fun.
And it was a liberal. It was more of a liberal arts school. And it was great because everyone loved it, because our credits were, we had four credit classes. So we only had to take four classes a semester. And your freshman year, you take the Friday morning class. But after that, you go, screw that, because it's party night. But I remember as a freshman, you know, you couldn't get into your classes. And so I was a business major, but my classes, I had like death and grieving. I had volcanoes. Like
volcanoes?
Whole class, they had a class about dinosaurs, volcanoes. And I learned the two kinds of lava. It's Aha and Pahoyhoy. That's the only thing I remember from that class. That stuck for some reason. But so, but with the motive expression, what kind of classes were there?
Well, I took, I studied in English Lit. And I studied in a lot of studio art courses. I studied in theater. Okay. I studied in, art, dance, and writing, basically.
Okay.
Yeah, art theory. And RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, is right down the hill from Brown. Right. And I did a lot of photography courses down there.
Okay. So you're well-rounded in the art field. So you graduate, and then what's your next move when you graduate? Do you go to New York? Do you know you want to go into the performance art field?
Moving to New York. I'm moving to New York from the time I'm 11.
Okay,
I'm
so you knew.
To New York. And my dad worked in New York. And my dad would always say, don't let the Big Apple make applesauce out of you.
Okay. I love parents' sayings. Like, my dad used to say, if it was raining, he goes, well, at least it's not snow. I'm like, yeah, Dad, it's August. It's not going to snow. I'm like, it's not going to snow in August. Come on. You know, it's like, if they say, but it's great. But the applesauce
That's
one's
crazy.
Classic.
Isn't that? Yeah. He worked in New York. And they used to take me to Broadway shows in New York. And I knew. And so I moved to New York, got a studio in Williamsburg.
Okay.
I thought I was going to be a visual artist. Very soon thereafter, I realized that visual art, the life of a visual, you don't, when you're younger, you don't necessarily understand that what you do involves, everything you do is a particular kind of life.
Okay.
Like, yes, you're very creative. How you're going to channel that, does that life suit you?
Right,
and
right.
And for visual arts, which I had some success in, I was making one-of-a-kind books, and very shortly after I started making them, one was shown at the Metropolitan Museum of Art Library. I mean, it was going well.
Right.
I was getting grants.
But what kind of books? What kind of just...
They were very apocryphal little stories.
Okay.
They looked very handmade.
All right.
And about... They're existential. I would say the stories were very existential. And humorous, but in a very... not laugh out loud way.
Okay.
Yeah. And beautiful. When I look at them now, I think these are very beautiful, and I'm proud of them.
And it must be. And you were young, and you're just out of college.
Out of college. I was very, jazzed and making my way. But I was like, oh, the stuff, the amount of stuff you need. I'm not, the accumulation of thingness.
Right, right.
Number one. And number two, I'm living in the ghetto, and I'm making, and I start to realize, what visual art is essentially making things for rich people.
Okay.
Like, you're poor, but you make things for rich people.
Right, okay.
And you're sort of the court jester. And then I started to think, I'd rather make things for more different kinds of people. Maybe I could do these books in performance, and then I started making the books really, really big and performing with them. I missed performing.
Okay.
I knew I didn't want to be an actress. I knew I didn't want to be a dancer, but I wanted to do some. So that's sort of
how... So you made big books.
These giant books.
Now, what would you make them out of?
I would go down to Canal Street and get crazy materials, big sheets of rubber and crazy paper.
You're not talking big, bigger.
8 feet.
Okay,
yeah.
Wow.
And I roll them on dollies and, hang them from the roof. And, sometimes they were in boxes, and then I'd open up the box.
It's very different. It sounded very cool.
It was super cool.
You're not used to seeing the show with someone with big books.
It was crazy. It was super cool, and I hit the scene, and I ran running, and then soon there, I did that for a while, and then I thought, this could all be multimedia and be a lot easier to tour with.
Okay, yeah, because, I mean, books, it's like, wait a second. But it's funny, because back then, though, it's now that you look at it. I mean, back, we talk about this a lot. It's like back in the day, the days back when, we all started performing. It's not like now. It's not like someone sends a link or someone says
it's
this.
All by it was hand. Like, we would go around New York and poster for shows. In fact, one of my posters is in Woody Allen, in Hannah and Her Sister.
Really?
There's a shot of somebody, one of the actresses, walking downtown on Worcester Street or something, and you see a Beth Lapidus poster.
Are you a big Woody Allen fan?
See,
I love Woody Allen. So to me, that's wow, that's cool.
I mean, it was super cool. I was like, oh my God, my poster is
Cool.
Yeah. So, so I love doing that work. And I'll tell you, there was something that, like, when you say messages from the universe about what you're supposed to be doing and stuff, I'd moved to a little tiny apartment on Mulberry Street because I wanted to be in the city.
Okay.
And it was a great location, and but I couldn't keep any of my work in my apartment.
Because it was that small.
And yeah. Okay. So I had a book, one of these big books, stored in the stairwell, and I was trying one summer to work Washington Square Park, which for an arty, you know, comedian performance artist, you don't do that. This is for fire eaters. You know?
Okay, yeah. Okay. It's like doing that on Venice Beach.
Yeah.
You know, next to the guy next to the old lady with the all-American bikini skating around. You're like, but she's 90.
I was fearless. I was like, I'm just doing
that's
it.
That's great, though. That's so great because, you know, I think, and that's only comes from youth. I mean, it's like as you're older, you don't have that. I mean, we used to always crack up in Philly when like a 16-year-old comic would come on stage. He didn't care. Fearless. All of us guys, we were like, okay, we want to do this because we were worried, but this is like 16-year-old kid from the hood. And he's like, I don't give a crap. I'm sitting here on stage. And you sit there and you think back. It's like, wow, I wish I had that fear. I mean, you had the fearlessness, which is awesome.
And I would roll this dolly, the sheetrock dolly, and guys would just volunteer to help me roll it. And so I would stand in a box that was made like a house, and I would tell stories. And my whole thing was like, I want to give people something interesting to talk about at dinner, like, you know, this crazy girl. Anyway, I'm in my apartment one night writing a story about a fire and this, you know, boy I'm in love with.
Now, how long were
these
stories?
Die in the fire. Yeah, I don't know. I was crazy little 2-page story, you know, and I save him from the fire, and I'm in the middle of writing the story, and bam, bam, bam on the door, bam, bam, bam. It's the fire department.
No, really?
Fire in the building, and it has started in my book.
Oh, my,
stairwell.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That is awesome. I love stories. I love stories like that because there's so many. It's like Wendy Liebman was on it. We were just talking about.
I love her, yeah.
She's been on a few times. We were talking about just these small, like these just weird stories or coincidences or whatever they are. But it's just, they're amazing. It's
signs,
like,
yeah.
It started in your book.
In the book.
And you were writing a story about the fire.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
So it was like, in my. So, and soon thereafter, I went to multimedia.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what do you mean as multimedia? Like,
I mean, at that time, slides. Now, okay. You would do it on your computer, but you know, images, you know, giant image landscapes and, you know, tracked sound.
Now, where
and after that I got funny.
Well, what kind of places were you playing at when you started?
I was playing at really downtown New York lofts and you know, up to the Kitchen Center for Performance and Dance was kind of the fanciest.
Okay.
And then on the road I was going to art centers, colleges.
Okay.
Yeah, I was touring.
So you had and this is from the performance art.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was touring this stuff in sometimes beautiful art, the IC Institute of Contemporary Art in London.
Okay. Oh, so
Institute
you were like
contemporary art in Boston. Oh, yeah, I was really doing it. You know?
That's so cool, though.
Yeah.
So now, what made your transition to comedy? Did you want to? We just,
you know,
tired
I started
of?
To get a little funny naturally.
Okay.
My inclination to be funny.
But your first stories, they weren't really funny. They're just
were
a little bit humorous, like
philosophically, you know, poignant.
Okay. Okay.
You know, and every now and then there'd be a funny moment. I wasn't ever going for funny.
Okay.
You know, they were more serious and deep.
Okay.
It was humorous in that I was this crazy, nutty, you know, wild child doing this stuff. And there was always a little bit of laughter in it. I always had included comedy. And then all of a sudden they started to get funnier on purpose.
Okay, so you started sitting there going, okay,
this is a little funny, and maybe this will be funny, and this will be funny, and, you know, the art world's not that crazy about the funny.
Okay.
So then... not on purpose. And... At the time, it's more porous now, and then also I started to get tired of the whole multimedia and the schlepping and the thing, and I suddenly was like at the mic, and then I did a show called Having Fun in the Dark, which was intentionally funny.
All right.
And but within the performance art context, at a space called PS122, East Village, very... East Village, Ann Magnuson would work there. Tim Miller ran it. I don't know, these names might not mean anything to the comedy audience, but you know, downtown New York. Eric Bogosian, maybe people know.
They know him from Law and Order. That's how they know him.
Okay.
They're like, hey, wait.
Yeah.
The guy who was a ball. Yeah,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
But that's how they know him. They don't know he was like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. People don't know that.
I know, that's what he says. Nobody knows.
It's like Bogosian. It's like, I remember.
He was a god. He was a god.
I mean, he played in Philly at like the Theater of Liberal Arts or something like that.
Willem Dafoe, people know from the movies. They don't know his work in the performance.
Isn't it weird how it's so funny? Because, well, that's what happens.
Yeah.
It's just, I didn't know Willem Dafoe did performance art.
He did. He was in Mabu Mines, and he did amazing work. Beautiful, beautiful work. So, anyway, Having Fun in the Dark was intentionally funny with a microphone as if stand-up. And after that, I started thinking, you know, I should... I think at a certain point, performance art is great when you're really young. And then,
right.
And then it's like, you know what? Develop a craft.
Right.
You know, at a certain... Go beyond just I'm expressing myself multimedia. Find a craft.
Okay. We're going to take a break. And we'll come back. I'm sorry.
Exciting.
We're going to take a quick break. And we're going to talk. I want to hear about you developing
transition.
Your craft.
Yeah.
Just because it's... Because you're leaving a world... I mean, it's... You're going from multimedia to now just stripped down in you.
It was exciting and brave.
Okay. And people, your website is...
BethLapides.com, okay. BethLapides, or uncabaret.com, uncabaret.com.
Twitter?
BethLapides.
Check, add her, people.
At
mine's,
me.
Mine's Cooper Talk Twitter, Cooper Talk Facebook. Also send me an email at Cooper at Indie100, I-N-D-I-E 100. Tonight's Wednesday. I will be at Sardo's at 8 o'clock, Brian Monarch's Comedy Experience. Come out. We'll be right back with BethLapides.
All right, morons, enough talk. Cooper Talk.
Remember abundance. At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening. Shakey's all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
With supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job postings just $25. Everything else, free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
Indie100.com.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. Also, don't forget to send out to a mail at geekworldradio.com. Send them your joke. They're a great show. They talk about the sci-fi world, all different stuff. They're on Fridays from 12 to 3. Also, listen Fridays at 3 o'clock. Myself, entertainment lawyer John Fagerholm, and comedian Sheldon Anderson talking about law and life in the show Living in the Law. That's every Friday at 3 o'clock. And yeah, so send a joke to geekworld. Mail at geekworld.com, geekworldradio.com, and you'll get a free CD, DVD. It's not bad.
Mm.
So we're here with Beth Lapides, who's, if you people know, Uncabaret is basically, it changed the comedy scene in LA, and that's the truth. I mean, people don't know that, but I mean, your show broke so many acts. I mean, like, it's funny because I'm sure Paul F. Tompkins would play your show.
Sure.
And when he was in Philly, we're like, dude, you have to get out of Philly. Just no one gets you. You're so funny. And we'd be
context is everything.
And yeah, we'd be like, Paul, leave. And then he takes off. Next thing, and we all knew it, though. It's like with him, all knew that just the way he was,
right.
He was so different.
Yeah.
He was on a show a while ago. He looks better now than he did years ago.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, Paul. I'm like, and he drives now.
Oh my God, crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
he's going to do the show in the summer.
Yeah. Oh, he's great.
Yeah.
But so, okay, so you're going from the performance art. And the multimedia. So you're going to start doing stand-up.
I do. There's one club in Soho, and I go, well, I'll go there.
Okay.
And they had a women's night, and so I got time immediately because I had stage presence.
Right. They knew. Okay.
They knew me a little. So there's a little crossover, but, you know, I was not that fun. I was weird. You know, I was offbeat, very offbeat.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I used to say my drummer's so different, he plays the tambourine.
Okay, that's funny. that's funny, but it's true, especially then with comedy. It's like, if you're different, I mean, at least in New York, it might be different, but if you're anywhere else, if you do something different, the crowd's like, it's like, that's why I wonder how Emo Phillips ever, you know, people liked him, because they were probably just thinking, what
so
the hell
weird.
Is this?
Yeah.
It's so weird.
So different. And, you know, I loved comedy. I mean, when I started doing comedy, I had such sort of a spiritual awakening about... I mean, one of the reasons... Partly it was I wanted to develop a craft.
Always
more... You know, I really feel like when people do things, there's always more than one reason. When people say why, there's not at least three reasons, you're probably not going to do it.
Exactly.
You know? So one was time to develop a craft. Two, love of language. Three, I had this moment where I was like, I could do everything I'm doing, but it could be funny. And being funny... is better than being not helping people laugh is on a higher plane than not doing that. So if you could take everything you're doing and also be funny, your life will have more meaning.
Well, you know what's interesting, and I was on your website, and it's so funny because in the beginning you did the multimedia.
Yeah.
But what I loved about your site was no props, and that's cool because I mean it's just
shtick.
Yeah, but that's cool because I mean you depended on not props, but the multimedia was somewhat props, big books.
Yeah.
And it's cool. It's like you become full circle and said,
well, it's funny. You know, the last one I went back to I did a one person show last year and a couple years ago. It was like, I got to get out of the uncab. Too many other people. I need to do my own show for a few minutes. And I did a show called 100% Happy 88% of the Time.
All right.
And that I went back to images in my artwork with that. It was fun to tour and have that again as a bigger... And music, and I've added music.
Okay, so that's cool. So you're hanging out in Soho.
I'm hanging out in Soho.
And you're doing your time now. Were you scared the first time? Because you've already been on stage. Was it you were scared of, wow, are they not going to think I'm funny? I mean, you know you can perform on stage.
Yes.
You've toured. You've been to places.
Yes.
People know you, but are you sitting there going, well, this is a different world.
I'm scared of, you know, a new life. I'm like, I think the first time I actually did Catch open mic, and that was panicky, but I just thought, I did a whole thing about bananas and dimensions and reality, and I had no idea, and the comedy crowd then was what not. I mean, I have changed comedy, and comedy is different. You know, it was very like straight, and I remember I did one. I was getting gigs. You know, I was starting to get gigs, and I did this one like Bridge and Tunnel. It was like somewhere out. You had to take the train. I can't remember where. And the booker said to me, the booker would book me, but he said to me one day, you know, it's really weird because they're not laughing, but they're listening. And that they didn't get that in the comedy world. And he said, but, you know, here's your problem. Comedy is 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, and you're going 1-2, 1-2. That's your problem.
It's so funny.
And so I would go around New York trying to step 1-2, 1-2, 1-2.
Well, it's so funny that we would listen to bookers because they were like, bookers were the crappiest comics ever.
Oh my God.
And they'd be sitting there and they'd get up, hey, you know, and they'd sit you and give you advice. Well, you got to do this. And it's like, well, if you knew how to do it so well, why aren't you like headlining your show?
That's true, but you know, sometimes people do know things that the people who best can teach can sometimes do. So but anyway, so you know, one thing I love about Uncabaret, just to jump ahead a minute, we'll go back, but I always wanted it to be so much that the people on the show have their own rhythm, and like you could tell that someone was themselves and not someone else within 2 seconds of listening to them. Their voice itself is so particular. That's I wanted it to sound so particular.
See, that's good. That's good. And that's okay. We're going to take on because I mean it's been around forever. I mean, we'll talk about how many acts you've broken, but you're in New York, and are you getting these little?
I'm doing the little things, and I'm still doing the one person shows, and I go back and forth because you don't ever get enough stage time. And I'm doing in New York also in the day. I don't know. I guess comedians are still like this. If you're not on stage every night, people will be like, I only have one set tonight.
Right.
Be like, you'd go down to the Comedy U, then you take the bus uptown to Catch, and then you go to the Improv, and it's like you book your whole night, and try to get on as many different shows as you can. And if you weren't on for 2 nights, you're panicked that you lost it.
That's
funny. My God, I lost it. That was on tonight, and everybody's like trying to hone that like 3 lines, and you know, trying to work those 3 lines perfect, and trying to take out the one word so the 3 lines work. And I mean, you know, and it's true, fine tuning comedy is you know, that is part of it, but it drove me insane.
Well, yeah, it is. Sometimes it's a little, it's like I've talked about this with other acts, like, and I'll be honest, in the beginning. I don't do it now. I used to cassette record myself.
Every single.
I never listened to it, though.
Oh, really? I did.
I would. I mean, I don't know why, because I would sit there and go, because to me, as soon as I got off stage, I knew if I screwed up a bit or not. Like, I would sit there and go, okay. I didn't have to listen to the tape because it was so obvious to me.
Yeah.
And even the crowd that knows, I was like, oh my God, I forgot to say that word. Or I said an R instead of an L. Or I just, and I would notice
right.
that. I would be very, I was always very conscious on stage. And I was the type that was, I could have a set where I could do 40 minutes, okay? And I could have, honestly, 97% of it could get laughter, but I would always remember the 3% that didn't.
Sure, that's what makes us comedians.
And I was like,
focus on the negative.
People
always.
Are like, really good set. And you're like, well, no, I screwed that up. They're right there and they're like, you're an idiot. I'm like, no, I'm just saying that's you. You think, but there's a lot of comics who don't do that. It's like, it's evident on Facebook all the time. Comics who walk and say, I rocked the stage.
Oh, I killed.
But you never say that. It's like, a room full of comics. You just killed a room full of comics. No, you didn't. I was there. And it always irritates me that they don't, these people just don't get it sometimes. Yeah. It's like, you don't come off. So you're in New York. Now, yep. What makes you move to LA? Is there anything certain, or were you doing comedy?
I moved a few times. One time I had two shows I ran at a theater here and then stayed for a while, then went back to New York to get married, and then my partner was screenwriting and got an agent, and you know, we tried to be bi-coastal, but that was really like, we couldn't even really afford to live on one coast.
Right, so. Right, exactly. It's
that's crazy. So I did feel, in a way, I never saw myself living in LA the way I said. I knew I'd grow up
right.
in New York. I never had an idea, like, I'm gonna, it never really occurred to me, but then here you are. And
now, when you were coming back, when you came out here to the theater, were you doing stand-up out here, or just...
The first time I didn't, but when I came back the second time, yes, I started doing clubs here,
okay.
And I also was doing one-person shows. I would go back and forth.
Now, did you feel it was a different type of crowd, just because, like, New York's more, I mean, I just say, like, with theater and comedy, New York's more edgy, you know, you can always tell an East Coast act, you can tell a Boston act or a Philly act or New York, because they're just different.
I felt comedians here were really just trying to get on TV.
Okay.
Like, I felt like it was coming from the comedians that we were all in a situation of showcasing.
Okay.
That everybody's trying to, they're tight 10 and trying to get their TV spots and get Seinfeld, you know, get their Seinfeld show.
Right.
And, so I felt like it was all very showcasey.
Well, it is very weird out here, because it's also, I noticed, it's like, it's always 7-minute sets. Like, I mean, I just went back and played my hometown, and I hadn't been back for 20 years.
Wow.
Performing there. It's like, you know, I was like, God, because I was, I'm probably not 20, but it was so weird when you actually get on stage, you go, okay, you can do 30. And you're like, wow, it's not like, wait, what? I can do, and you're only going after, like, instead of going after, like, 7 acts, to do, like, 7 minutes, you sit there and you go, and that's...
Yeah,
I mean, I would go crazy if I was a comic and I started out here. You can't grow because it's all that 7 minutes,
right.
7 minutes.
But there were a lot of, one thing that did happen, though, there was a lot of road gigs.
Okay,
like there was that was at a time when there was,
no, there's everywhere,
you know, everywhere.
I mean, every.
So it was a kind of strange time, because I was in my little, you know, car driving to Rancho Cucamonga,
all right.
And you know, to Pacoima and all these crazy places, and. Working rooms, I just couldn't. I mean, I'm like, to be the girl who, you know, had been getting NEAs, like, you know, a few years ago, and now I'm playing, you know, Caro's Family Restaurant.
Exactly.
I was like, it was such a disconnect.
And,
it was like dissonance, you know, it was like.
Hey, that's just really, I always say,
and I just, but sometimes I'd show up in these crazy rooms and like do my thing, and they'd really love it.
Isn't it? Yeah, it's like, you can never judge a room. It's so funny. I performed in Cedar Rapids years ago, and I was thinking, this is going to be awful. And it was the hippest crowds. I was sitting there going, I got off stage and go, wait a second, they just got that reference of, you know, about Tracy Gold from Growing Pains. I said, how did they get that? You know,
you know, and I'd be philosophical, and sometimes they wouldn't get it, and then, but, you know, it was, and I remember, but at a certain point, I remember I followed somebody who was just telling just butt joke after butt joke, and it was one of the wars had just broken out, and it was so depressing, and my grandmother, he's doing like my grandmother's butt, and I was just like, and when I was sort of riffing, then I riffed afterwards about it, the audience was with it, and as soon as I went into my material, they like closed up, and I was just like, I gotta get out of this rack, I don't know what I'm gonna do, but I can't do this anymore. But I was still working in LA, I was working at the Comedy Store, and I was following Andrew Dice Clay one night.
Okay.
And I was hating him, and I was hating the audience for liking him, and I was hating myself for being there.
Okay.
And I was hating my act that I had sort of you know, fashioned in order to work in this situation. And I really was like, something has to change. Like, I cannot do this anymore.
So is that when you came? No, were you out for LA for good then?
Then I had moved out here for good.
Okay,
yeah, the second
so
time.
Is that, like you say, you know, like with the, just things happen, like with the fire.
Yeah.
Was that your moment where you said, I got to do a show, like, I got to do something different? Is that,
that
when
was,
Cabaret
that
came
was
to your mind?
Of, well, or? That was, it was a double moment of clarity, because that was the first thing. Then the second thing was, I was still doing the one-person shows, and I was getting ready to take one of them to Your Had Been Well Reviewed. I was going to do one night at this crazy art space downtown called the Women's Building.
All right.
And it's the show called Globomania, and they were laughing way too much. Like, you know, you have these audiences, sometimes you, like, touch your hair and they think it's funny.
It's like, it's a setup. Don't be laughing. It's a setup. It's not even a punchline.
It's as funny as you think it is. And you're like, oh, if only I really was this funny.
Right. I know.
And it's, so you're, like, judging them, but you want to believe them.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
you're like, what's wrong with these people? I'm not that funny.
Maybe tonight I really am this funny. Can I just bring you everywhere with me and always be this funny?
I have
funny.
A bus. Come on. Yeah. I'm going to be a star.
And after the show, because this was a fully scripted show, and so I after the show, I said to them, you know, when was the last time you laughed? It just wasn't that funny. And they said, well, we're women and we're artists and we're lesbians and we can't go to comedy clubs because they make fun of us.
All right.
So I said, you know what? When I get back from my tour, I'm going to make you a show. It's going to be unhomophobic, unmisogynist, unxenophobic. It'll be the Uncabaret.
Okay.
And it was born in that moment.
Just, and that name just came.
Yes.
That's so cool. So it's like, no, so you, but were you...
A need, an audience in need. And this is what sometimes people forget about performing is it's not about you.
Right.
It's about the audience.
I know. Most people go, with the audience suck. Well, then, no, you know what? Then you missed a step. Because it is, bottom line is, I mean, it's
sometimes
basically...
context, and it's not a good fit. It does happen.
Right. I know, but it is...
Serve the audience. Find your audience.
Right. We're there.
Find
like with
it.
My show. I mean, I found my audience.
Right.
People listen, and they go, I get emails, and they go, oh, I love the comics you get on. Yeah. You know, you're talking about different stuff, and that's my audience. And I was sitting there, I'm not going to do bits. I'm not going to do that. I get people who are interesting, you know, and it's so funny because I think it's the comics that are funny. I mean, if you're funny off stage, when you're not trying to be. I mean, it's like you have a story.
Well, this was the third thing of, like, you know, so there's the Andrew Dice Clay incident, and there's the... you know, audience at the Women's Building who are in need. And then there's my friends who are really funny.
Okay.
And I'm on the phone with them and they're so funny. And then I see them in the club and they're not funny.
Exactly.
And
it's
I'm
so
like,
weird.
Can it be more like we are on the phone? I want to do something, some way of making comedy. And, you know, when we say context is everything, I really truly believe that. I was reading a book about CBGBs, which if your listeners don't know, is, you know, the music club in downtown New York, Broken Talking Heads, Patti Smith, you know. And David Byrne had a great intro to the book and was saying how much the club had influenced the music and everything about the club, not just the booking of the club, but the physical architecture of the club.
Okay.
The way the room was shaped, shaped the music. And it's so, you know, you go, okay, well, where is it going to happen? How's it going to be?
Right.
We did the Women's Building a little bit, and it was just sort of thrown together and
this was
crazy.
This is already Uncabaret. So but you figured you had to find
it. We tried. You know, it wasn't clear what it was going to be. We just knew it wasn't going to be like it was in the clubs.
Okay.
They lost their funding, moved it to a place called Highways Performance Space, and it was just me, Taylor Negron, and Judy Toll.
Okay.
And we did a bunch of nights there, and then I took a break and ran for First Lady. I ran a campaign to make First Lady an elected position.
Okay.
But always in the back of my mind, big media campaign, back of my mind on Cabaret, on Cabaret, on Cabaret, I got to do this project again.
Now, how were the crowds react? Okay, you have this on Cabaret, you have this idea. Now, are you getting crowds from the beginning, or
the beginning, we're getting crowds at these performances.
Was it like from people that you talked, like the woman's thing, that they said, this is a great show?
Oh, then their audience just comes, and they just tell their audience. They've got a built-in audience to their space, and these people want it, and they're loving it.
Okay.
Then at Highways also, they have kind of a, you know, an audience of their venue, and these people haven't seen comedy, really. They're not getting to laugh. So this is like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is
and it's
great.
Different. It's stripped down. It's more, it's not like, hey,
it's
you
talking,
know.
It's storytelling.
Okay.
You know, even from the beginning, it's very personal, it's storytelling, it's conversational, and they're digging it. Then I have in mind I want to do it, but I can't find a venue. I'm looking at theaters. I'm looking at clubs.
Okay.
I can't find the right space. And then a guy named Jean-Pierre Boccaro, who is a well-known club impresario in Los Angeles. He had the Lhasa Club in Luna Park, where I'd performed a couple of times, opened a new club, a Lhasa Club in Largo, I'm sorry, and opened Luna Park and called me and said, do you want to do something here? And I said, well, comedy. And he's like, no. And he booked it for 3 Sundays.
Oh, right.
And I sometimes say it was like the Gilligan's Island of shows, because we were booked for 3 Sundays and ran from the week the club opened to the week it closed 7 years later.
Wow, that's so good.
So that was really the finding of that room. Luna and Park. I could tell you what was great about that room was, number one, it was underground.
Okay.
So it had this feeling of you walked right downstairs into the subconscious. It was a little too small, so you felt it was really super intimate. So the intimacy was really encouraged from the beginning. There was no dressing room, so performers had to be in the room. There was a lot of things that made... There was a restaurant upstairs, so it encouraged hanging out. I mean, there's just a lot of things right
about
that
room. It was just
right. It was in West Hollywood, so everybody could get to it. There was easy parking.
Okay.
I mean, everything about that room, and the fact that Jean-Pierre was kind of... I love him, and we've just had dinner recently, but he was very worked up and kind of an asshole in the day. And the fact that he was so... He ran the club artistically.
Right.
So every act around the club had a booking policy. It's not, you know, a lot of times clubs are just like, if you pay and you can get enough people, you
right
can have the club. He was a snob.
See, that's good, though. That's good.
Yeah.
We're going to take one more break,
okay,
and we'll come back. And we're here with Beth Lapides. Go to her website, BETHLAPIDES.
BETH.
I spell Lapides right. I spell Beth wrong. We were just talking about that earlier. I'm like, I hope it's not Lapides. But you have to ask us, because then I sound like the asshole when the guest goes, oh, by the way, Steve, it's Lapides. And I go, my mom always taught me, always ask. You'll never look stupid if you ask. So anyway, send Twitter, too. And On Cabaret is every Sunday. And we're going to talk about that when we wrap up. Also, send me an email, Cooper at 92 Indie. God, I'm going crazy. Cooper at Indie100.com. Follow me on Facebook. We'll be back with Beth Lapides talking about some of her upcoming shows and the On Cabaret, which is just a great, great show. You have to check it out. So we'll be right back. I always have problems with... We're still on air.
Only a sip as his guests. Cooper Talk. The stupidity continues after these messages.
Remember abundance. At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening. Shakey's all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
With supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job postings just $25. Everything else, free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
Indie100.com.
Welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guest. Tonight, come see me at Sardo's, right there in Burbank on Pass Avenue. It's a nice little place. And we have Beth Lapidus. We're going to talk about some of her upcoming shows, because you had the Uncabaret.
Yes.
And then Luna Park closed. And so, but who were some of the acts that you came through there?
In the day, who was the original, the OG, as we like to say. Who was the original gang? Judy Tall.
Okay.
Taylor Negron. Bob Odenkirk, David Cross, Dana Gould, Andy Dick, Janine Garofalo, Kathy Griffin, Julia Sweeney, Bob Goldthwait, Andy Kindler. That was super core.
Did you know them, or did you know them from the scene, or just the people said, oh, you got to check this act out?
A little both. You know, some people I knew and had seen, and some people was like, I didn't know Bob and David personally, and Janine was on, and she was like, you got to have Bob and David.
Okay.
You know, there's definitely some of that. And, you know, and then you go see people, and sometimes you would go, and that's not right for, and Scott Thompson came in later on. I remember there was a funny, Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall, and there was a funny thing where he had seen the show, and, you know, and then it was also in the early, I mean, in the first, like, 6 months, 8, 9 months, let's say, the very beginning, it was just like, don't do your act. Like, I know I don't want you to do your act, but what is it that I do want you to do?
Okay.
That was a little, like, how to figure out what to tell people. And another thing that happened is because at the very beginning, audiences were light, and we were trying to really get, like, people to see, and they'd go, I hate stand-up, and I'd go, it's not like that. You've got to come, you know. So then people did start to come, and then people were bringing their friends, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, you can't do anything you did last time because it's the same people.
Right, okay.
They're here again, those same people.
Which is great, though.
So that was part of the reason for the one rule that people became famous of, like, you can't repeat yourself.
Okay.
But it wasn't that you couldn't repeat yourself. It's just I didn't want people to do an act. I didn't want them to say things just because they were funny, partly, as I was saying, because comedians were all doing their tight 10 on stage.
Right.
What I would tell people is do the stuff that if you don't do it, your brain is going to explode.
Right,
like,
okay.
That you need to say. And another thing that was happening, it was 92 when we started, and Clinton had just gotten in, and there was a shift in the zeitgeist to a place where it became very much more self-reflective. It was less us and them, which is what the comedy clubs really are. Very you and me, you know, very us versus
right.
them, like heckler versus comedian, very killing and
right.
taking it
yeah,
down.
Definitely.
And Judy Tull used to say, she was a Philly girl, and she used to say, oh, the Uncabaret is the comedy of love.
Okay.
And if there was, if ever she would come and there would only be like, you know, I'd say it's a light night, we only have, you know, 40 people or whatever, and she'd go, oh, good, it's going to be a great show.
Okay.
Because of that intimacy. And so I tell people, do that material, your brain's going to explode if you know. And then there was a giant article in the LA Times on a Friday above the fold in the calendar section. And by that time, little other shows had popped up, and there did start to be a movement a little bit. But Uncabaret was always the play. And so I would tell people, no characters, no bits.
Okay.
And Scott Thompson famously came, and I saw him getting ready to go on stage with a wig, and I was like, what are you doing? And he was like, you know, man. I was like, no characters. Well, I can't. And that's what I'm. I'm this huge fight. And, you know. And then he went on stage and just told about the fight, and how there was like a, what happened was there was a mic in the back of the room, and because people were then having to do material the first time out all the time.
Right.
There would be questions, because you know from being a comedian, the first time you do something, you might do the setup a little wrong,
right.
or you miss something. And being somebody who has listened to a lot of comedy, I would be able to ask a question. So I was just sort of the ears of the audience.
Okay, so yeah. that's cool, though. So yeah. That's good. So this ran for 7 years?
7 years, and then I was sure. And what, you know, in that 7 years, I had a daily radio show for a year.
Okay.
We did the Comedy Central show. We kept the live show going every Sunday night, no matter what. I mean, 2 Sundays every December we would take off.
All right.
So we ran for 7 years.
And the crowds were big, right? The
crowds were big. You know, in 7 years, I'm not going to lie, there were some, you know,
oh, yeah.
little up and down, but, you know, big. You know, the summer was hot. We had to add second shows and, you know, crazy. And but, you know, basically it was sold out for 7 years.
Okay, so then the restaurant...
And then the whole place closed.
Okay.
And then I thought, okay, we're dead. We're done. We're dead. And then
did you feel like a part of you was gone, though? Because you was so, you revolved with it so long, and you,
I remember
you
the
helped
last
so
night.
Many, what happened the last? Because you must have been, and you helped so many people's careers. I mean,
yeah.
it's like, so what was last night? What was
I don't remember who was on, but
no, but what was it like
standing,
for you?
I was just so surreal. I remember I kept the glass that, you know, my last drink was in
okay.
last night. You know, standing in the parking lot, just being like, wow, it's over. And I think, though, before it ended, HBO Workspace had approached us.
Okay.
And said, will you move it to the HBO Workspace? And I said, no, I don't know, you know. And then, but then it's the HBO Workspace, and they were like, you know, it was when HBO and Warner Brothers were trying to, you know, synergistically AOL, and it was some crazy cockamamie. They're putting in the video, and they're going to stream it, and we're going to pitch it to HBO, and there's some grand, you know.
Okay.
And we did end up, you know, pitching it to HBO and with them, and it was, that was crazy.
So it closed.
And
now what?
And then
what
we did HBO Workspace. And then what made me keep going?
Yeah, I mean, how did HBO Workspace end? I mean, how long since it's come back? I mean, because it's just recently back, right?
Or was yes. So we did those 7 years, and we did HBO Workspace for a year.
Okay.
Then we moved it to the Knitting Factory,
which closed.
But also, we left before the Knitting Factory closed because we had some great shows there, but they were big. It's such a big room,
right?
And you know, it's really interesting to as I was saying, context is everything, and it was an interesting experiment to try to move to that kind of cavernous
oh yeah I can
club.
Imagine especially because you're so used to the intimacy just that kind of that hip feel, that cool feel, because that's, you get a certain feel in the room.
So is it going to work? We had some great nights, but ultimately we felt it was too big, and then M-Bar became available and we moved it there. And that was also very Michael Patrick King, who had come in. He was the producer of Sex and the City,
right?
And people know him as Best. He's a great storyteller. I mean, that's one category of people we'd love to work with, were people who had been stand-ups and left stand-up to become TV writers.
Okay.
And over the years, some in the Young Cabaret and some in an offshoot show called Say the Word that was all written pieces that we did up at the Screwball. So
so how'd you end up at...
M-Bar was, you know, and Michael Patrick King once did a show on Cabaret there, and he was like, this is like being inside of Bob Guccione's cufflink box.
Yeah.
Which, that was the feeling. It was...
I performed there. Yeah. I know. It's just a very weird. I mean, it's like...
But it is intimate and warm.
Yeah, but it just has that weird, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not laid out.
Yeah.
So how long ago did you start the new one now?
January 15th, so we're, you know, a couple months.
So what made you... what made you want to, and what made you pick... I read the article. There's an article on our website, people, which check it on BethelPetus.com, which says why you sold the setup. And it's very cool back there.
Right. It's a beautiful, beautiful room. In a story like the book Catching on Fire, a friend of mine had been having a hard couple of years, and a friend of mine gave me a card that said, it was like a street sign that said, hope in one way.
Okay.
And, you know, I moved 10 times. There's a whole story. You know, there's a long story. We can get into it on the next show.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm moving around, and I really just have a suitcase and this card. I mean, that's really all I'm moving with. And then a friend calls Mitch Kaplan, who's my co-producer on the show and the musical director, and says, you know, I'm working at this place, and, you know, maybe you and Beth should do a show there. And I'm coming up with all these other ideas. We should do Playtime with Beth and Mitch, this or that. And he's like, why don't we do on Cabaret? I'm like, that show's dead to me. I'm never doing that show again.
Why did you have that out? Were you just like bitter about it? Or just, you know, like, it's part of your life? You're like,
it's just, you want to change.
Okay.
You don't want to repeat yourself.
Right.
And
but it was such a hit, and you help so many people out. There's a whole new group of comics you can help out now.
But in my mind, in some ways, I had spent so long hosting and launching people, and there was a part of me that was like, no, you know, maybe I've launched enough people, and
exactly.
It's time for me, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense. Totally makes sense.
You know, and me as an artist in a different context than that context.
Okay.
On the other hand, we went to look at the room, and it's like the perfect room for Cabaret. It's perfect, and the fact I'm carrying around this card that says Hope One Way, and then the club is called First and Hope.
Yeah, it's funny, and the thing about it is, I mean, when I performed there, because I don't like to drive in downtown LA, so I took the subway, and it's a station right there. But it's so funny because that hill is so, I don't know if you ever walked from subway. This hill is like the way the hostess goes. I go, can I walk from the subway? She's like, yeah, there's a little hill. This is like the steepest hill.
It's like San Francisco.
I thought I was going to have a heart attack.
Oh,
I'm
my
like
God.
Halfway up.
Well,
but it's a great location.
Yeah, it's great. It's very easy to get to, too. You just take Beverly turns into First, and that's it. I mean, if you're in LA, just get on Beverly and keep going.
I produced a show once a month called Cooper's Angels, where I host all female comics at Flappers.
Oh, nice.
And I get really antsy, and it's not for me, it's for the comics. I don't want people to come out and have no crowd there, because then I feel bad.
Of course, I had no idea. Are people still interested in the Uncabaret? Is it still relevant? I'll tell you the reasons why I brought it back.
Okay.
Number one, the room is, you know,
beautiful.
Freaking beautiful and perfect. Intimate. We're talking about that intimacy. It has that intimacy. And it's very comfortable, and the sound is good, and lights are. So that's reasons to do a show there.
Right.
But maybe not on Cabaret. But the intimacy is there for on Cabaret. Second, I really missed everybody. I was like, you know, being a comedian, you...
They become your friends. They become a part of you.
You don't necessarily see them because you're doing your work. They're doing their work.
But when you see them, it's like you haven't. Like, I used to do it when I was on the road.
Yeah.
You don't work with a guy for like 5 years.
Yeah.
And then you hang out with them on the weekend. You're like, you look and you're all excited. Like, oh, I'm going to work with this guy, Eric Kornfeld, out of New York. I was like, oh, Eric, I'm working with Eric. You know, and you'd be like, cool.
Yeah.
And you just hang out that weekend. And it was like you just saw him yesterday.
Yeah. So I missed my group of, you know, comedian friends. That was number two. Number three, you know, we're living such strange times.
Right.
And the On Cabaret has always been about change and evolving and growing and being in the moment. And I was like, this moment that we're in, which is all about change, you know, and that's been what 100% Happy 88% of the Time was about. And I'm like, how are comedians dealing with, if I make the On Cabaret available to comedians again, what kind of material is going to come out of that?
Right, okay.
And so I felt like the time was right to see what we're talking about now. Like, how is that different? Then third, I became interested in you know, Mitch doing the music, and I became interested in the past couple of years of the integration of music and comedy and the emotional ride that you can go on. Because the On Cabaret has always been a very open kind of comedy. It's always been, you know, Julia Sweeney is such a great example. You know, sometimes the setup would be 2 minutes before she would get to the funny thing,
right,
which then would be 20 minutes of, like, nonstop laughing.
Okay.
You know, but... The roller coaster of On Cabaret and the emotions was always there, but with music, you really can go into a cathartic kind of emotional experience. And I thought, well, let's try that. You know, let's try where because I feel like right now people are so on edge and so need that kind of catharsis and so need to laugh. So, you know, that was another reason to try that. And then I thought, maybe, I don't know, then I just got very interested in, I've changed, and, you know, it's like when you go back home and you're like, you see how you've changed because you're in a place that you've been before, rather than you just keep going to new things.
Right.
I became interested in it as a place of measuring my own changes.
Okay. Well, that's good, though.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah.
And now, who are some of the acts you've had since it started?
Since we started. Okay. Margaret Cho, who I somehow forgot to mention was part of the original group, has been on a couple of times. Laura Keitlinger also was part of the original group. Greg Fitzsimmons, Meryl Marco, Mike McDonald.
Okay.
Mark Maron, Tim Bagley, Greg Berendt. Who else has been?
So a lot of
Coco Peru, Miss Coco Peru, Jill Sobule in music area, Andy Dick, Sandra Bernhardt, and I would say Roseanne.
That's so cool.
I'd say it's cool, but
it shows that your show still has legs. People remember that. And they probably are sitting there going, and they probably love doing it because it's, I mean, a lot of these people, I'm sure, are now playing clubs, and it's a little different when they play, but here they can be like, wow, this is what we came from.
This is our
breeding ground.
It is. It's home. It's home to a lot of people. And, you know, there's new people. There's, you know, people seeing new people.
Right.
There's some of the original people seeing new people. Moshe Kasher is somebody who hadn't been in the original group and it was on. And great. Selena Luna is new. She was wonderful. Taylor Negron's going to be back this weekend. You know, so it's a mix of the old and the new and people getting to see new people. Eddie Pepitone I'd actually never had on. He was on last week.
He's crazy. He's great.
Crazy and great. And then the music, you know, and adding the music. So it's all been a really wonderful, wonderful experiment.
Now, show times are?
8 o'clock.
On Sundays.
Always Sunday.
And now?
Trademark on Cabaret Night. That was a happy accident because we randomly picked Sunday. And then as it turned out, because Ellie is so showcasey, even industry who would come did not come on a work day.
Right, okay.
And so the suits are unsuited. You see what I'm saying? So people came as themselves in the audience.
Now, so what's the cover to get in?
The cover is $20.
And they have very good food.
Very good food. The $20 includes your first drink. And there's also a $55 ticket, which includes a whole meal in the beautiful restaurant before the show.
Their food is good. I've had it. It's very good food.
Yes, delicious. And then, or you can eat a light bistro menu in the showroom. So it's really commodious. It's a lovely, lovely, lovely Sunday night. Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up.
That went fast.
But no, just so you know, I don't know if I have are you going to stay around if my guest isn't here?
Sure.
You have an
talk
hour?
More? I have... thousand hours
good.
Than
well,
me.
We're going to see what happens, because I always record in two different segments, but if Frank's not here, because I've heard back from him, I would love to have you on.
All right, otherwise I'll come back,
and
I promise.
Then, yeah, then we can talk more about, we can do a whole hour about Uncabaret and all that, because I mean, you people, it's as I said, as you know, and it's not a derogatory term, but as comedians call non-comedians civilians, and that's and so if
we need you though, we need you.
Oh yeah, though, no, you guys make us. Yes. I mean, it's like anything, and the civilians make us. But I'm saying it's like in the civilian world, a lot of people wouldn't know. I mean, it's not they're going to go, well, Beth, you know. And as I say, if you're a comic and you don't know her name, then you shouldn't be a comic. I mean, that's. I mean, if you don't know your name, I mean, I remember when I first moved out here, I would see the little Luna Park, and this, I would see. The ad in the back of the LA Weekly, and I gotten out of the business end, but I was like, cool, you know. So anyway,
that's nice.
But so your website is BethLapidus.com.
Yes, or Twitter, uncabaret.com.
And go, people, this Sunday, every Sunday. The Sunday is Taylor Negron, who you'll know him. He's been in so many TV shows.
He was the
shows.
Pizza guy in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yep, and he was the guy, he was the mailman in Better Off Dead. So you'll remember that, people. Anyway, hit me up.
Thanks
Cooper.
So much, Steve.
No problem. Cooper at Indie 100, INDIE100.com. Tonight, Sardos. I'll be there. It shows at 8:30. Every Friday, listen to Living in the Law with John Fagerholm, myself, and Sheldon Anderson. Cooper Talk at Twitter, Cooper Talk on Facebook. You guys are great. I have some great guests coming up in the next few weeks. Rick Overton, Kelly Carlin, John Campanera. So keep on listening, people. Have a great weekend. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper, and I'm only as hip as my guests. I'm out of here.